Miami Commissioner Ken Russell won re-election. What does he see for the future of the area's transportation needs and the battle against sea level rise? Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Commissioner Russell's greatest challenge is ahead as he now continues the fight to improve transportation systems in the city that loves cars. We'll also look at his answers for creating more affordable housing in one of the most expensive markets in the country. Also, the Girl Scouts' origins go back more than a century, and through that time, they have grown with the culture.
Inclusivity is a part of what we do. We've always been very open and welcoming to all girls.
We'll hear from a South Florida troop about how they've evolved over time. And a new exhibition in Coral Gables highlights the work of young children from the Guatemalan Mayan Center in Lake Worth. We'll hear about their stories and how they express themselves through the art. All of that today on Sundial. First, the news. Welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. There were elections throughout Miami-Dade County this week. Commissioner Ken Russell was reelected to another four-year term in the city of Miami's District 2. District 2 runs mostly north along the Biscayne Boulevard corridor, just south of Southwest 40th Street to Northeast 54th Street. Commissioner Ken Russell joins us now to talk about his priorities in this race. Commissioner, welcome back. Congratulations.
Hey, Luis. Thanks for having me.
You know, we're just chatting just now, and I didn't realize, I mean, the election actually went 9 months. The campaigning went 9 months.
Yes, I started quite early. I knew I wanted to run for re-election.
Why?
You know, there's a reason there's four-year terms and that you're allowed to serve two. It takes about that long to really get big projects done, to find the funding, create the legislation, and then actually implement. It takes a while.
For you, what are the biggest priorities? In this district, what's most important?
Well, the two big things facing us are a housing crisis that is it's very apparent, and thankfully it's taking it on is welcome from all sides of our dais and the community. We have the backing of everyone to go tackle this, and so housing is huge. And also our infrastructure for sea level rise and storm surge. Those two things are probably our biggest.
All right, let's tackle some of these issues. Let's talk about housing, and specifically, though, For the folks in District 2, what is that one thing about housing? What's the big challenge, the big issue?
Well, we don't have enough of it, and we're losing 1,200 units of affordable housing every year. So no matter how fast we create it, we can't even keep up with the loss of housing. And as Miami becomes more and more unaffordable, it affects everything. It's a bubble that it's not sustainable or tenable for very long if we don't make this a city for everyone. They have to commute an hour, 2 hours to get to work, and it just, you know, exacerbates all our other problems.
It's such a strange thing when you think about it. Is it to say we don't have enough of it, and yet we're building lots of luxury homes and condos? We got plenty of that.
Well, there's always an investor out there, and they may be a foreign investor, they may be local. There's money for that, and that comes and goes and swings. But if we're not also creating a city for the people who work here and live here, it's not tenable.
Tell us about the Miami, remind us of the Miami Forever Bond.
Yes. Yeah, so this is something that started a couple years ago. This is a $400 million bond, general obligation bond that was passed by City of Miami voters. And it took about 2 years to get it on the ballot because I wanted to make sure the administration got it right. The first year I was the swing vote that kept it from getting on the ballot. Second year it got on the ballot and I campaigned for it. And my fellow commissioner, Keon Hardiman, and I pushed for the housing side. He said he wouldn't even vote for it unless it had $100 million of affordable housing. And I was right there with him, as was Commissioner Gort. So it has $100 million for affordability and $200 million for resilience, storm surge, and stormwater master plan. And then the remaining $100 for parks, for cultural and safety.
And this is overseen by a community advisory board, right?
Yes, we have a board. The city administration manages it, and the city commission approves the projects.
So talking about, again, $100 million for the affordable housing aspect of it, I mean, we want to see how that gets started. Where do you see that being implemented now?
So some people said, hurry up and spend it. We're already behind the, you know, eight ball on this one. And some said, whoa, don't waste it. Please use it right. Please leverage the funds. Find state and federal money so that $100 million could disappear overnight if we don't do it right. So we partnered with FIU's Metropolitan Center, which was a great move because it really, even though we spent the first tranche of the bond, we started the spending and started identifying some projects and things we want to do. their guidance has really helped us recognize how we need to spend this smartly, because affordability is a huge spectrum. It's not only the person trying to get out of homelessness and into their first apartment and back on the rung of the ladder. It's young professionals who can't afford to live downtown, or teachers that can't live near their school. So we have a big project to tackle. And the most surprising thing that's come out of this study is the importance of preserving existing housing stock. Normally, people think of building towers and such when you want to build new housing. But the idea that we're losing stock so quickly, and these people that own their home, but they may be fixed income, veteran, elderly, or lower income, helping them stay in those homes through simple fix-ups, storm windows and energy efficiencies, keeping their bills down. Those little sorts of investments keep them out of becoming a larger burden to the city.
Are both of those arguments, though, valid in that, okay, hurry up, let's get in there and spend it. The other part, of course, let's do it right. I mean, really, can't you do both?
We need to, and we have. We didn't wait for FIU's advice, and we started. We issued an RFP for the first batch. We are doing $4 million in single-family home rehab, and we're actually going to the courts to make sure we can get an opinion that we can spend public dollars on private land. As a general obligation bond, you're supposed to be doing capital projects on city. And we're also subsidizing developers that are doing affordability. We're buying land. These are all things that we're looking at.
Remind us of the Affordable Housing Master Plan, the city's Affordable Housing Master Plan.
Yeah, so this is the thing that FIU is working on for us, and they're going to unveil it for us this month. I've gotten a sneak peek in meetings with them, and that's where some of these figures come from. But for them to identify that Miami is the most cost-burdened city in the entire country, and by far, no one's even close when it comes to how much people spend of their salary on their housing, whether it's a mortgage or rent, we are spending more than anywhere else in the country.
Do you have to work with developers, or do you feel this is a competition against them?
No, the best way is to find a carrot and stick with developers. And so one of my jobs as commissioner is to oversee zoning issues with my fellow commissioners. We vote on what can be built and where and how big and how dense. And so when these private developers come to the table, we're now able to look at them and say, hey, are you interested in getting in the affordable housing game? Because normally they're not. And if it's only been left to the true traditional affordable housing companies that sort of know that whole HUD dollar tax deal, we're leaving a lot on the table that could be done. So through inclusionary zoning, which was a concept that I've introduced to the city of Miami, the first of its kind in the state, it mandates workforce housing within market rate buildings in a section of downtown, actually where we're sitting right now. That's never been done before, but it was only accomplished through a carrot and stick in cooperation with that development world.
And I keep hearing from people, it's again the incentives. And I'm just, I always keep asking, do those incentives work? This is, I mean, because Miami is like, it's like the gold rush. I mean, I can imagine for developers and people in real estate. So, you know, why would they take anything less?
Exactly. And if you try to put it all on their shoulders, they're simply not going to do it. The state, in fact, tried to preempt the inclusionary zoning concept because there was the thought that we were just telling the private world they'd have to solve our affordable problem. And once they realized that we are actually incentivizing development to do what we want them to do, that legislation didn't touch us. It was amended in a way that allowed our inclusionary zoning to continue.
Again, talking with Commissioner Ken Russell, District 2 in Miami. He won re-election this past week. Let's move over to the other big issue, environment. And, you know, it's the whole area is dealing with the issue of sea level rise, but your district especially. How are those conversations within your district about the flooding issue, the oncoming sea level rise issue? What is it that they're talking about right now and as to where to begin to deal with it?
Well, it's again, a very multifaceted issue. You got to look at it holistically all the way around. And when we think of resilience, it's not just about liquid water rising. This is about people and livelihoods and affordability in the ridge. All this comes back to the same conversation of resilience. Can a city bounce back from adversity? So on the sea level rise side of things, bringing in experts and specialists to make sure we do it right and not waste the money quickly. This is the other half of the bond, was very important. But we're moving quickly on this one because we know if we don't shore up our infrastructure, it's not that the water will inundate us. It's the lack of ability to get your homes insured or get investment here.
I think back a few years ago to a conversation I had with a former Coral Gables mayor. And one of the things, I mean, he was, you know, for him, the issue was very important. But he said to me, but my people just want to talk about trash pickup and, you know, my neighbors parking incorrectly in the neighborhood. Are your constituents, are the people talking about this? I'm not saying that's the only thing they talk about, but are they talking?
Absolutely. And I've been listening to Nadege Green's three-part piece on climate change gentrification. I can tell you it does exist. And after just finishing this nine-month campaign of knocking doors, and I want to write a book called The Grassroots Diet because you get a sunburn and you lose 15 pounds. But by going door to door, you hear it. And I actually found many, many folks who I had knocked 4 years ago on my first run who had moved, and they had left below the ridge and they had moved to above the ridge, and they had gotten hit in Irma, and it wasn't worth cleaning up again. It wasn't worth going to insurance and FEMA again. So they're starting to look inland. And as chairman of the Downtown Development Authority, which is another hat that I wear, it's been talking to the business side of investment in Miami and making sure that we're taking the steps to give assurance to the rest of the country and world that Miami is a good place to come and bring your business and bring your family and move to. And so instead of hiding from the issue, it's been about making it at the forefront and that we are addressing it. So yes, people are talking about it. Money is moving based on the issue. And we absolutely need to take our steps as a city to really fortify our infrastructure.
What does the city, because you think about how Miami Beach is handling it, obviously, and that we've had this conversation about, you know, it, raising roads, seawalls, you know, what communities might be lost in the future. We may have to give back to Mother Nature. But for your district, what do you see as, you know, what some of those solutions need to be in the next few decades? Well, because we have to start planning now.
Sure. For those who don't know, District 2 in the city of Miami is all of Coconut Grove, Brickell, Downtown, Edgewater, Morningside. This is the waterfront
next
of the city.
Next to the water, yep.
And most of this below the ridge was sort of reclaimed from the bay, and it wants it back. The bay is coming for it. And so many of these streets that go down to the bay experience flooding even on the sunny day, as we've all seen now. And so we're installing one-way tidal valves, which keep the water out during these high tide situations. We're doing pumps where necessary. We're looking at all sorts of new alternatives, such as permeable asphalt and different ways to shed and absorb water. It's all about the flow of water.
Let me shoot over to transportation real quickly. I mean, again, a lot of big transportation issues are on a county level, but let's look at this one because this is a fascinating topic. This past spring, you launched an e-scooter pilot program. Tell us about that.
So this is probably the riskiest thing I did during an election year, because the target demographic of those who use the scooters tends to be a little bit younger, and they're not allowed to be used by anyone under 18, which is something we're clamping down on. But a lot of young professionals are using it around Brickell. People use it to get from the train to their home or to their work or out to lunch, and this is great. In that six-month period, 1.1 million rides in my district alone. All of the money that the city earns has to go towards new bike lane infrastructure. And it's actually working. We finished our first bike lane before the end of the pilot program using money generated by the scooters. However, the voters who turn out the most in my district are they demographically older, more pedestrians than scooter riders. And so through the HOAs, I got a lot of pushback over quality of life issues on our sidewalks. And that's something we need to work on.
And these are, I mean, look, the debate about these obviously is because now you have another mode of transportation on the roads. And there's always the debate between cars and cyclists and pedestrians. And now you have scooters. And some people react really negatively to these things.
Sure.
You know, I wonder how do you think we have to deal with this issue as we move forward? Because it's here and it's probably not going away.
We have to control the companies who are providing the service, and we have to educate the riders who are using the service. And that's what hadn't been done in other cities. And so these aren't really transit companies. These are investor companies. These are you know, VC companies trying to make a buck and get their brand out there. They offer a great product and service, but when they're competing with each other, we're the victim if we don't control it. So we actually introduced quite a heavily regulated system with caps on how many they could put out, how many companies could be here, where they could put them. And then now the part is trying to regulate the riders to make sure we don't have underage riding, reckless riding, drunken riding. And so fortunately, very lucky in the city of Miami that we have not had a fatality in the 6 month period. Although we have had in cyclist fatalities, car fatalities, this is another mode, but I know it is part of the solution because we're seeing over 7,000 rides a day just in my district.
He is Commissioner Ken Russell. District 2 won his re-election this past week. Lots to talk about. Congratulations on the victory. We'll have you back. We got a lot more to talk about.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm really excited for the next 4 years.
All right. Again, and if you have any questions or any thoughts, you're from District 2, about some of the stuff we've talked about, you can always find us on Facebook or Twitter at WLRN Sundial. Love to hear your thoughts about what's going on. All right, let's stay on the issue of politics, specifically voting. The Florida Supreme Court heard arguments yesterday about Amendment 4. This is the constitutional amendment passed by Florida voters last November that allows former felons to gain the right to vote. However, one of the questions that's been subject to litigation is whether former felons should be required to pay back all of their associated courts, fines, and fees before they can head back to the ballot box. Well, WLRN reporter Danny Rivero has been following this story very closely. He joins us now. Danny, great to have you back.
Good to be here.
All right. The Florida Supreme Court reviewed the language in Amendment 4 at the request of the governor. What specifically is Governor DeSantis wanting clarified here?
So Governor DeSantis asked the Supreme Court to look at this question, and he asked for what's called an advisory opinion. And what that is it's not looking at a specific case that someone brought. It's more of like just guidance to the state in general terms to tell the legislature, the state, what the law is, like what the interpretation is. But they're not looking at an exact specific case. So that's what Governor DeSantis did. He did that in the context of there's an ongoing federal lawsuit that was brought by many people who have felony convictions and then regain their right to vote after Amendment 4 was passed, and then with this added part that you need to pay fines and fees, many of those people lost the right to vote after they regained it, so there's federal litigation. Governor DeSantis separately asked just for clarification at the state level of what this all means.
And this goes back to SB 7066, right? This is what was passed this past legislative session. The governor signed. Again, it's supposed to... The debate, the controversy was, we're saying, okay, you can get your rights back after you've paid back your fines and your fees, right? That's what the argument was about.
That is what the argument is about. And in Amendment 4 itself, this was a little bit up in the air. It was somewhat ambiguous. It said, you know, you regain your right to vote after you complete all the terms of a sentence, but it never defined what all the terms of a sentence is.
Would paying these fines and fees be end of the term?
Exactly. Okay. Exactly. So SB 7066 went in and it said it specified this includes all the fines, fees, restitution, basically any money that you owed. And then since Governor DeSantis signed that, there's been a lot of movement in the courts.
What was the response from justices about those requirements, about those fines and fees? What did they say?
In general terms, they haven't issued in this advisory opinion yet, so we're still waiting on their final decision. But just judging on the questions they were asking, the skepticisms that they were showing, they seem to be entertaining the possibility that money owed is part of a sentence and that it can be a condition for someone being able to regain the right to vote.
And the ACLU had a different approach in their oral argument from what they've previously stated. What's the distinction that they brought, again, when it relates to this idea of fines and fees?
So before this Amendment 4 went onto the ballot, some attorneys that were helping Amendment 4 get onto the ballot went before the state Supreme Court. It looked a little bit different then because we got some new justices. But the Supreme Court asked them, would fines and fees be included in all terms of a sentence? And the attorney that was representing them then, who is also an author of this, said yes, fines and fees would be part of this. The ACLU helped put out voter guides that said that fines and fees would be part of this. They wrote letters to the Secretary of State that said this. And then now after SB 7066 passed, which made that explicit, they've said no, fines and fees are not included in the sentence.
So they reversed what they said originally.
I will say because the justices did ask them about that in the court yesterday. The ACLU attorney yesterday basically said that they consider fines and fees that specifically have to do with finishing your restitution. I'm sorry, not the restitution, finishing your probation, finishing your parole. If there's fines specifically attached to that, which oftentimes there are, then they consider that potentially could be part of your sentence. But many times if you get arrested or convicted, there's separate fines and fees attached to it.
I'm talking with WLRN reporter Daniel Rivero. Yesterday, the Florida Supreme Court hearing arguments about Amendment 4 and the question of whether former felons should be required to pay back all those fines and fees before regaining the right to vote. You could find more of his reporting, by the way, at WLRN.org. Staying on the ACLU, they're calling this, by the way, this law, 7066, a poll tax. Have there been challenges, legal challenges to it, or the focus, again, just clarifying on what Amendment 4 is? I mean, again, they're saying this is a poll tax. People have made that argument.
So there have been many challenges. There was, I think last count, I think there were 6 federal lawsuits. I might be wrong on that, but they were all consolidated into one lawsuit that's moving forward. And the last month, the judge who is running this this federal court, he issued, it's not a final opinion, it's kind of a temporary opinion, and he told the state, he said, you cannot keep someone from voting if they genuinely are unable to pay whatever they owe. So that's a distinction we have here. The federal court at this point says you can't keep someone from voting if they genuinely cannot pay. He didn't go so far as to say you can't say that someone needs to pay money before they vote. He said if they can't pay, you can't keep them from voting. And he said specifically, let the Florida State Supreme Court deal with the question of if you can ask them to pay in the first place, which is what they did yesterday, and that's what we're going to find out about soon.
So what happens now in these lawsuits? Where are we at?
So the federal lawsuit is scheduled for trial in April. We'll kind of wait and see what happens then. It's going to be after the presidential primaries. So any impact it would have on the majority of the people that could be impacted by this and their right to vote, they wouldn't be able to participate in the primaries. And the state Supreme Court, we're waiting on whatever advisory opinion they issue.
And so those federal lawsuits could be decided by April. Could the Florida Supreme Court's recommendations affect that in any way if it comes out before?
Good question. And so the advisory opinion that we're waiting on from the state Supreme Court is technically not binding. So the state's not, they don't have to follow it. But we're expecting that they're probably going to issue this sometime before the next legislative session. So if there's some kind of tweak that needs to be made, possibly in the next legislative session, the legislature would come back and make some adjustments. The federal judge, when he wrote his legal filing last month, he kind of made some suggestions to the legislature, and people, some senators have said, okay, our ears are open. You know, if we need to make some adjustments and make this, you know, legally sound and make this workable, then there's some indication that they might be willing to do that.
So the legislative session starts in January. It's early because of the election next year. Interesting that if the courts wait till April, that does impact a lot of people who want to vote in the primaries. Maybe this all gets decided before next November. WLRN's reporter Danny Rivera, again, talking about Amendment 4. Read up on his stories, his coverage on this issue at WLRN.org. Thanks a lot, Danny.
Thanks for having me.
All right, still to come, our conversation with a local Girl Scout troop, and we're going to learn about how the Girl Scouts have evolved over the last century. That's coming up next. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. Well, the Boy Scouts and Girl Scouts are among the oldest youth organizations in the country. But the two groups have evolved very differently. In 2018, the Boy Scouts decided to drop boy from its name and started welcoming older girls. Now, this led to the Girl Scouts of the United States of America filing a trademark lawsuit against the Boy Scouts of America. Earlier this month, we talked to local Girl Scout Cammie Bumpers and Girl Scouts of Tropical Florida CEO Chelsea Wilkerson about the changes they've seen in the organization over the years and how they continue to recruit young women. Let's go to that conversation. Why are young women interested today to join Girl Scouts?
In the last few years, there's been a heightened sense of urgency, both among young women and adult females, adult women, to really rally around each other, to support each other, and understand that we have so many opportunities. We've moved the needle in leadership and with women in leadership, but it's only gone so far. I mean, we're still underrepresented. Among those in leadership that were women in leadership that were Girl Scouts, there's a high percentage that were Girl Scouts in leadership positions. We're still underrepresented. So for example, the current congressional class, 23% female. We've made inroads, but we're still under 50%. Now, of that 23%, 60-something percent were Girl Scouts in their childhood.
Cammie, you've been a Girl Scout since kindergarten.
Yes.
So you've been at it for a long time, but how did you get into it, though?
So I got into it through my mom. Before I was born, she was a leader for my cousin Marlena. And then my cousin Marlena graduated high school, and my mom said, when I have kids, they are going to join Girl Scouts. So when I was growing up, even being 3 and 4, I saw troop life. I saw girls going to meetings and having fun. So I was so excited to become a Girl Scout.
What does it mean to be a Girl Scout?
I am so proud to be a Girl Scout. I tell everyone that I'm a Girl Scout. I wave my Girl Scout flag everywhere I go. I usually we're known for selling cookies, and I feel like we're so much more than that. I talk about the community service that we do. I talk about the experiences that I get only through Girl Scouts. And I make sure to mention that to non-Girl Scouts because, so that they don't have that perception anymore.
You know what, by the way, because every now and then we might hear a little jingle, you have your vest on with your badges and your awards. All right. So one of the obviously one of the fascinating aspects of Girl Scouts is the fact that over time you get to earn so many badges and awards. And of course, Cammie, you are wearing your vest. You have all of these badges and awards. I'm not going to ask you about all of them because there are a lot that you're wearing. But just tell me about a couple of them and what you've got there and the process.
Every year, well, for 4 years, my troop has done the Old Cutler hike, which is a 14.7-mile hike from Bayside to Old Cutler. And it just builds endurance. It builds sisterhood. Going on that hike, you just want to give up. You're just like, my feet hurt. I'm tired. But you just push through, and then you encourage each other to make it. And it's just amazing. So these are my badges. I only have 3 on me right now because the 4th one is framed.
You've been in it a long time. So tell me about like something you've noticed that's changed over that time.
I feel now Girl Scouts has a new mission to bring more girls into the STEAM fields, which is science, technology, engineering, and math. And so especially now, you at Girl Scout events, we have a lot more women who have been very successful in those careers come in and talk to these girls and tell them that you could be more than what you think you could be. And so especially now, I've met a lot more people through Girl Scouts. Like I've met astronauts, I've met girls who code, I've met scientists, I've met naturalists in the Everglades, stuff like that. It's becoming very more career-based and helping girls choose a career that they can be successful in.
It's opening up to all these different possibilities for your future, which is a lot of it, as you said, is career. Chelsea, I wanted to ask you about this. Before you got into the Girl Scouts, you worked with foster care, child welfare in Miami-Dade County, as you said. Well, tell me how that helped you in the transition to this role.
You know, a piece of my heart will always be in the foster care system. It really helped me understand the diversity in our community, the needs in our community. And one of my accomplishments that I'm so excited about that we're doing here locally is because of that kind of passion and commitment that I bring from having worked with children that are among the most deserving. We're expanding our community troops program, which is a program that ensures that girls from low-income housing communities and underserved communities are able to be a part of Girl Scouting. So when I came in, the program's been a long time here in tropical Florida, which is Miami-Dade and Monroe counties, the area that we serve. And through funding from the United Way and other community partners, we're now in the process of doubling the size of that program. So growing it from 300 girls from underserved communities to 600 girls this year that will be participating in Girl Scouts just like CAMI. They're going to be camping and getting outdoors. They will be doing STEM activities, community service projects, selling cookies and learning entrepreneurship skills and business skills through that cookie program. And so I think it definitely, for me, helped that the experience in the foster care system definitely, for me, helped make sure that I am always anchored on being sure that we're able to serve all girls.
How has the Girl Scouts changed in opening up and being accepting to all kinds of people and you know, from different walks of life?
Mm-hmm. Inclusivity is a part of our DNA in Girl Scouts. We have always been one of the most inclusive organizations in this country. We've always been open to serve all girls. And that is a point of personal pride for me to be associated with an organization that has held that value center in our core of what we do. Nationally, we have a national commitment to being inclusive. All girls are welcome to join Girl Scouts, as they have since the very beginning and the very founding of Girl Scouts.
You talk about inclusivity, and I do have to get to the question about the inclusivity with the LGBTQ mm-hmm. in community. Mm-hmm. Tell me how that's evolved and where Girl Scouts are on that.
It hasn't evolved because we've always been welcome to anyone.
There are conversations about self-identity and how mm-hmm. people identify. Mm-hmm. And these are conversations that are pretty open, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, and like I said earlier, we're here to serve girls. So if you are a girl, we welcome you. Any girl, anyone who checks the box and is identifying and living her life as a girl is welcome to join Girl Scouts. That's who we're here to serve.
Been talking with Girl Scout CAMI Bumpers and Girl Scouts of Tropical Florida CEO Chelsea Wilkerson, the South Florida chapter of the Girl Scouts, celebrating 97th anniversary, special anniversary luncheon coming up November 12th. I want to get into something a little more serious, though, because I wanted to get a clarification on this. The Girl Scouts of the United States of America filed a trademark lawsuit against the Boy Scouts of America last year, and this came after the Boy Scouts decided to drop boy from its namesake, mm-hmm. And they started welcoming older girls.
So I can't really comment on ongoing litigation. The lawsuit's really about trademark and trademark infringement, and that's kind of as far as I can go with what's going on. It's just important to point out that the lawsuit is taking place at a national level between our national organization, Girl Scouts of the USA, and their national organization.
How would you describe the relationship between Boy Scouts and Girl Scouts?
It's a very, we're two organizations that happen to share the last name, but beyond that, we're very distinct culturally. Our organizations have evolved very differently. And right now we're at a point where, you know, rather than commenting on what another organization is doing or how they're going about running their business, we're really focusing in and laser focused on doing what we do best, which is serving girls. For over 107 years across the United States and 97 years here in Miami-Dade and Monroe counties, Girl Scouts have put girls at the center of everything we do. We are experts in girl programming. We are experts in leadership development. There is a reason that women who were Girl Scouts over index in STEM careers, in leadership positions, in elected official positions. It's because the skills that they're learning in a gender-specific environment as Girl Scouts carry with them their entire lives.
How have you both evolved differently?
Like I said, inclusivity is a part of what we do. We've always been very open and welcoming to all girls. We've always been sure that some of the other maybe social or political issues didn't get in the way of interfering with serving girls and reaching into our community. We are also, there's some differences kind of in how councils charter troops versus chartering individual troops. The core is that Girl Scouts are you know, girl experts that have been serving girls for a very, very long time. Locally here in Miami-Dade, I'm really proud of all that we've accomplished. Our Girl Scout membership here is growing. Our council is in a stronger position than it's been in a very, very long time. We're bringing in community partners. We're engaging across sectors. And women are coming out of the woodwork first to identify as alum. They're excited to share, hey, I was a Girl Scout, and I now realize that first time I sold a box of cookies was the beginning of my business skills. So women are excited about what's going on with Girl Scouts. Girls are excited to join. And our community is really rallying around the importance of developing leadership skills in girls.
Cammie, I mean, you're a junior, so you're coming up at that time when you're going to start applying for colleges. How important is this, your career as a Girl Scout, to that application process? And how are you going to make sure that universities see that and say, hey, look what I've accomplished?
Getting into college in the present day can be very challenging because a lot more people are applying for colleges. So I feel like Girl Scouts has given me the opportunity to stand out in a lot of ways. Girl Scouts, especially with the Gold Award, because nowadays colleges don't just look at your studies, they don't just look at your grades, they look at how you're getting into your community. And by Girl Scouts giving us gold, silver, and bronze awards and encouraging us to go into our community, it's giving me something to put on my application. And I'm just so thankful for that.
No doubt. It's so much harder today. I'm glad that I'm not young anymore. I can't let you guys go without asking you. This is, it's what Girl Scouts, you've mentioned it a couple of times, Chelsea. It's what Girl Scouts tend to be linked to, which is the Girl Scout cookies. The Girl Scout cookies, the sales of these cookies, it's built a brand, but it's also something, as you said, to use in entrepreneurship skills. Why do you think, first of all, the Girl Scout cookies are so popular? Why?
So when you're buying Girl Scout cookies, you're really making an investment in a young girl's early entrepreneurship skills. There's a full program that goes behind the Girl Scout cookie program. And so a couple of things here. One, the Girl Scout cookie program is the largest girl-led business in the world. We have girls here in our community who are able to fund their entire Girl Scout experience through the sale of the cookie program. So that means that their troop is meeting at the beginning of the year. They're planning out the activities they want to do that year. And it might be they want to take a trip, they want to do some community service, they want to go camping, and they want to participate in some badges. And in order to do that, they need a certain amount of money. Girls then are learning goal setting, because how much money do they need in order to be able to do those things? So they're setting goals, how many boxes they'll need to sell, and then they execute on that business plan that they're building. And so they're learning marketing skills, decision making, money management, communication skills. All of those things are going into the sale of that cookie program.
I will be honest when I tell you this is some of the best salespeople I've ever met, young Girl Scouts. Cammie, real quickly, tell me for you personally, how selling Girl Scout cookies has taught you those skills.
Girl Scout cookies has taught me how to do quick math. It has also taught me how to sell a product, how to advertise, how to reach your audience. Because if I'm selling at the zoo, it's people who just spent all this money at the zoo and now they're coming out. Are they going to buy Girl Scout cookies? How I say, wow, these Girl Scout cookies are really nice. You should really get them. They're going to be so worth it. They've also taught me money management skills, also inventory counting. There's a lot that goes into selling Girl Scout cookies that I feel like the public doesn't see or doesn't think that deeply to see.
So if I come up to you and I say, give me 3 boxes of Samoas and I got a $10 bill.
You don't have enough. They're $4 a box.
She is good. She's got it all right packed down. Best cookies. Which ones?
I love s'mores.
Give me the Samoas.
Hey, here's a little teaser. New cookie coming this
year.
Mm-hmm. It's lemony. It's delicious.
That's as much as you're going to tell me?
Yes. You gotta pay attention in early January. We've got big news coming.
And again, that was local Girl Scout Cammie Bumpers and Girl Scouts of Tropical Florida CEO Chelsea Wilkerson. Next week, the Girl Scouts of Tropical Florida will be celebrating their 97th anniversary at the Lifetime of Leadership Luncheon at the Rusty Pelican in Virginia Key. You can find more information on our website, WLRN.org. And by the way, a question for you. Should the Boy Scouts allow girls to join their organization? We want to hear from you. Share your thoughts. Find us on Facebook at WLRN Sundial. Well, still to come, there's an exhibit in South Florida of artwork that looks at immigration and family separation, all of the work created by children. That's coming up next. Welcome back to Sundial. There's a new exhibit at the Coral Gables Museum featuring self-portraits of 17 children from Lake Worth. The portraits are called Retratablos. They were created by student artists ages 6 to 12 from the Guatemalan Maya Center. Their art includes images of Mayan deities, Catholic iconography, and American pop culture. The project was funded by the ELLIES, a series of grants awarded to individuals with special art projects in South Florida. Aurora Molina is an ELLIES Award recipient and the Miami-based artist behind Retratablos. Aurora Molina, great to have you. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you for inviting me.
All right. First of all, let's remind people of what is the Guatemalan Maya Center.
The Guatemalan Mayan Center is an institution located in Palm Beach County that started in the 1980s as an initiative to receive immigrants that were coming from Guatemala during the genocide and civil war. So they started as a five-staff organization, and they have opened and continue to outgrow their program, reaching out to younger audiences, giving after-school care for kids. One of the reasons that is so special, it's also because they speak three languages. They connect with the parents of the children in three languages, indigenous, from Guatemala, English and Spanish. So they'll be able to guide them through the whole process of getting used to a new country and city.
Yeah. What inspired you? And this is, you have a co-project leader, Alina Rodriguez,
yes,
on this, right? What inspired you to put this project together and bring this issue to the front?
This comes after I started the project in 2013, and I have done it in several countries. And last summer, I was watching TV, and I just saw these on a TV channel. I was watching the news, and there was this voiceover of the children crying at the detention center, and I just knew I had to do something. So it was an emotional impulse, I guess, that answers the question, to work with this very specific community of kids coming from Central America. And I joined forces with Alina, who really was the one who foresaw making a bigger and a more organized program. And that's what we did with the kids.
So let's talk about what the program is. How would you describe it to somebody? You know, again, because you're talking about children producing art, and that art represents a lot of emotions.
So what we did in this very particular project was to bring symbolism and a lot of meaningful colors, like all these layers that connected to the kids through their cultural heritage. So when we presented the project, other than also working off of a self-portrait, we told them that they were going to create visual narratives, and that every symbol that they will pick had to be something meaningful for them. So we presented them with patterns and designs from the Mayan culture, also symbols that they knew. We talked about global symbols like the heart and the peace sign, and just they started to create like a glossary with 20 symbols that were meaningful for them, each one in particular, and right next to it, what it represented. So they were able to pick, like, we talked about Nahuales, which is a spirit animal in the Mayan culture, and they were able to connect to the Nahual that, you know, depending on the date and month they were born, belonged to them and what kind of connection they had. And little by little, they started to get it, and they started to not only add the 20 symbolisms that we asked, but more. And that's when they started to bringing a lot of pop culture symbols, making it more their own.
You know, we had our intern, Nirmal Malaikal, who went to check out the exhibition earlier this week, and he talked to a Jessica Domingo. This is a 9-year-old artist. Again, who was part of the project. Let's listen to her describe her portrait.
I drew myself portrait. I put signs and like tattoos that meant that signal something. There was a cross on the nose. That cross meant church, and there was a bird on my face that signaled my parents' country.
Tell me a little bit about Jessica's story. This is so much fun. I can listen to that for a while.
I know, right? I get goosebumps. She really got into it. There was something that she really got from within the culture, and I think it's part of the parents being so proud of where they come from that she already had inherited that. Because we will wear weepils for the class, and she had told me that her aunt even was making a weepil for when she turned 16. So, like, even in the pattern of the clothing that we will present to them, she will get it. And she will borrow patterns from there. She made a beautiful background for her piece that symbolized running water. And she said she had that connection with the ocean, and that she felt free, and that she felt at ease. And in her particular case, she didn't mention it here, but she put the cross, she put the American flag right in between her eyes. And in her cheeks, she put Tu Quetzales. So I think for us, that really resumed the project, which was to touch base with this connection of their ancestry.
And by the way, just to say too, we have some of this artwork, and it's absolutely gorgeous. Talking again with Aurora Molina, she is one of the creators behind Retra Tablos. It's an art exhibition at the Coral Gables Museum. It's featuring self-portraits of children from Lake Worth. These are children who created them ages 6 to 12. And again, we have some of these pictures of the art on our Facebook and Twitter at WLRN Sundial. Definitely something to check out. They are not just because they're so colorful and bright, but also, again, because you think about who created them and what they're saying. There's a lot of emotion in these pictures. What does, by the way, Retra Tablos mean?
It's a word combination of retrato, portrait, and retablo, which is a Spanish heritage in Latin America, that it's the frame, the gold frame, or the big a frame that's in the church that's with gold leaf. So mm-hmm. It was a way to frame and emphasize that the portrait was something to look at, sort of bring the eyes to the center.
Something else too, because you have the work that was created by the children, but then you also had some of it, at least I believe, was transformed into embroidered textile replicas, and those were on display as well. Tell me a little bit about those. Where did those come from?
So the second part of the project, the project as a whole, also connected to the textiles as a medium, so that kids could see that's also part of an intrinsic part of the Guatemalan culture. So I had connected to a community of women in Guatemala, in Quetzaltenango, in Chela, it's called, a cooperative that started I think it's happenstance, because it started right when the Guatemala Mayan Center also was incorporated. And they started as a way of creating autonomy, because most of the men in their family were disappeared. So they started to look at the weaving as a way of bringing income. And it's a cooperative that works with 400 women in all that area, six regions. And when I presented them the project as a fiber artist, it's also part of my practice to go and learn these techniques. But it was the first time also that I was going to Guatemala. So I presented them with the idea of working on this very particular project. And we couldn't figure it out. So it was them interpreting the kids' work and finding different textile techniques. They use backstrap weaving, which is an ancient Mayan technique, and embroidery. And they had complete freedom to look at the kids' work and be inspired by them. And we have gotten a huge feedback, because it's been one of the few projects where they really felt freedom to express themselves.
How did the kids respond when they saw these replicas of their own work?
what we brought them to the class. We got back from Guatemala on a Sunday and we couldn't wait. So we went to see them on a Monday and they were at all because it's, you know, it's like, and someone is working off of my drawing. So there was a huge, a huge moment that make them proud and sort of like makes sense because we have been talking about textiles, we have been looking at patterns of textiles, and I think it hit them,
yeah,
that this was finally, you know, all the yada 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 finally makes sense.
The work is absolutely beautiful. Again, it's an art exhibit at the Coral Gables Museum featuring self-portraits of children from Lake Worth. Again, find these photos. You can find some of the artwork on our Facebook or Twitter at WLRN Sundial. Aurora Molina, again, the creator of Retra Tablos. Aurora, thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Please check out those photos. They are absolutely beautiful. Well, that's our program for this Thursday, November 7th. Coming up next week on Sundial, when was the last time you flew out of Miami International Airport? What was your experience going through security, getting to your flight? We're going to have a conversation with the CEO of MIA, and we want to hear from you. Plus, Palm Beach County recently closed the only county-run facility for those with severe mental illness. Now the county commission is scrambling to find housing and services for those in need and seeking help from the state. And our conversation with this month's Sundial Book Club author, Edwige Dantakot. She was here this morning. We talked to her. We had a great conversation. Check out some photos on social media. You'll hear that conversation next week. By the way, join our book club. It's on Facebook. I'm Luis Hernandez. Have a great Friday. Have a great weekend. We'll talk to you again on Monday.